Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm all the better for hearing you, David.
I always love the way you respond to that question every week. That's great. Right. So any day now, Joe Biden is going to announce who he's going to select as his vice presidential nominee, his running mate. And we're all, I guess, holding our breath to see who he picks. But we thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about the vice presidential selection process, how important it is, the sort of antecedents for this particular election, and see if we can sort of provide some context for what's going to be, I think, an interesting milestone in this particular campaign.
Yeah, it should be noted, we're really talking about the selection of vice presidents in electoral politics, not the vice presidency as an institution and kind of people as vice presidents,
right,
per se. I mean, just an important qualifier. And the other thing I would say, just by way of introduction and in terms of if people are really interested in more recent history and the history of selection, again, I can't recommend the Pod Save America short podcast series on this, The Ticket, which was released about a month ago, that's I mentioned in a last drop in an earlier episode, but that's a three-part series that's really, really good.
Yeah, but that was focused mostly on sort of like the past 20, 30 years.
That's right, okay. That's right.
Which is obviously relevant to this particular election cycle, but in some ways is actually very different than how VP has been picked in the past. So I think maybe one place to sort of think about is you know, the way in which a vice president gets selected has changed a lot over the past 200 plus years. Your man Thomas Jefferson was vice president for a while. How did he end up as vice president?
Yes, in the beginning, David.
In the beginning, because I mean, I think the way that they, you know, for the first 20 years, the way in which they picked vice presidents was very different than everything since then. So how did he end up with this thoroughly mediocre job?
Well, in the beginning,
the
way the vice president was selected according to the Constitution was whoever came second in the Electoral College vote for president would become vice president. And so John Adams, it's less important in the very beginning. So John Adams is selected as George Washington's vice president and serves throughout Washington's two terms. And then in 1796, Jefferson and Adams ran against each other for president in what's the first kind of contested presidential election. Jeff Pasley of the University of Missouri has written a very fine book about the 1796 election. And as the first true loser in a presidential contest, Thomas Jefferson was rewarded by
becoming the first winner in the first vice presidential contested race. Right?
That's right. Yeah. So everybody gets a prize. He becomes John Adams's vice president. Now, if one thinks about the prospect of Hillary Clinton having to serve as vice president to Donald Trump, that seems just horrendous to us. But in 1796, it made sense for the following reasons. The framers of the Constitution saw the Electoral College as being this kind of removed body that would select the president. And because the people vying for the highest office in the country should be above partisanship and above partisan bickering, they should be selfless, virtuous public servants. Why not take the second best candidate and make him, and it would always be a him in their eyes, the vice president? So that was the thinking at the time. It worked more or less in the Adams administration, in part because Jefferson and Adams were friends, although they were about to become estranged in part because of their time together in the Adams administration. But, you know, to our minds, it seems like a recipe for chaos. You know, the example I gave a moment ago about Hillary Clinton having to serve as Donald Trump's vice president kind of illustrates that. With the election of 1800, which we've talked about in the past on the podcast, which is the one where Adams loses in the Electoral College, but Jefferson and his notional running mate Aaron Burr were tied in the Electoral College. that's where the real problems in the system came to light. And that
this is the one featured in Hamilton.
Yes, well, it's also featured in reality.
Well, I guess, but
anyway, so that's the one decided in the House of Representatives in February of 1801. Jefferson is chosen by the House to become president. He's inaugurated in March of 1801 with Aaron Burr as his vice president. They had a very, very poor relationship as a consequence of that electoral controversy. And the kind of people who'd lived through the framing of the Constitution thought, oh, maybe we got this wrong. And this was rectified via the 12th Amendment. And the 12th Amendment calls for the Electoral College to have separate votes for president and vice president. So to some extent, the first couple of vice presidents, the first several, really don't count in terms of our discussion today because they weren't running mates. They were runners up. and I would argue it's not really until kind of 1836 or really 1840 when, you know, we talked about presidential conventions party conventions last week, selecting presidential candidates. I don't think we get a kind of fully fledged kind of party system with conventions selecting candidates, including presidents and vice presidents, until about 1840. If you will, the kind of the vice presidency as something people run for with a running mate kind of dates from about that period. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's, you know, maybe slightly earlier, but I think we're you know, picking at straws there. I think it's you know, with the development of the second party system that you really end up with running mates in the sort of way we're familiar with. You know, and one thing to think about during the 19th century that makes it very different from today and different from most of the 20th century. And we talked about this briefly in our last episode. It's, you know, we now think of the person who was nominated as the presidential candidate picking who their running mate's going to be. And in the 19th century, it was often the party who picked who the vice presidential candidate was going to be, independent of who the person at the top of the ticket was. And we can sort of think about sort of reasons for why that happened. I mean, one of them is that the presidential candidate usually wasn't at the convention, you know, and the sort of idea that the convention is a place to sort of showcase the candidate. You know, the convention was there to pick a candidate, not necessarily to have him in attendance. And so, you know, the decisions were made without those parties actually being present, and are usually made to sort of balance out something within the party itself, to sort of, you know, if there was sort of some, you know, horse trading going on, to pick who the presidential candidate was going to be, and then usually somebody from the other half of the party to be the vice presidential nominee. And so we can think of in 1860 when you know, the Republican Party nominates Abraham Lincoln, they pick Hannibal Hamlin as the vice presidential nominee for a variety of reasons. He's from Maine. Lincoln is from Illinois. Lincoln was a former Whig. Hamlin was a former Democrat, you know, and so they're coming from different parts of the party, different geographic parts of the country. But the two men had never met. And actually, you know, when Hamlin is vice president, they very rarely saw each other.
David, can I just note that, you know, Hannibal Hamlin is one of the great names in the history of American politics. It's a very good name. It's
got lots of good sort of
it does actually
names. Yes.
Anyway, so you were making a real point.
but you know, those kinds of decisions were quite. That was sort of the mechanism for picking the vice president. It's not a great job. Right. And so, in fact, there were lots of people who were offered the position of vice president in the 19th century who said, thanks, but no thanks. I'd really rather be in the Senate, or I'd really rather be a governor, that there was, you know, legitimate power with those jobs. That, whereas the vice presidency, you know, he's the president of the Senate, which is important sometimes if you've got a 50-50 Senate. But otherwise, there's nothing to do.
And you know, Adams pointed that out, you know, said it was really useless. And others, there are various famous quotes about people talking about how useless the job is. So that's right. And of course, in the latter 19th century, the presidency itself kind of diminished in importance. So being vice president was probably less important than being a prominent senator.
To be sure.
In many cases, in almost all cases.
And in some cases, you know, what they would do is that, you know, the vice presidency was where they would put somebody so they wouldn't cause problems. And the probably the most famous example of this is in 1900 when McKinley is running for re-election. Teddy Roosevelt is the governor of New York. There's lots of Republicans who don't particularly like him, and they don't like him being governor of New York, where it's actually a position of power. They say, let's make him vice president because then he won't. Can't do anything because it's sort of a neutered position. Well, it turns out that that didn't work out in the way they thought because McKinley got assassinated, but it was sort of a seen as a sort of a black hole of places to put people. You know, and we can think of other examples from the 19th century where the person who's put in the vice presidential slot really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, the one that comes to mind is in 1880. Where you had a bunch of people running for the potential top seat for the Republican Party, and they end up, after a whole bunch of ballots, ending up with Garfield, who was not one of the front runners. He was one of the dark horses that we talked about last time. And then for very complicated things having to do with the internal politics of the Republican Party, they picked Chester Arthur as his vice presidential, as his running mate. Chester Arthur, a person who had basically no national level political experience. He had been the collector of the Port of New York, an appointed political position under Grant. But that was it. I mean, he was basically a low level bureaucrat. But he gets put on the ticket because it was, seen as a way to sort of balance it in terms of various party factions. And he ends up becoming president when Garfield gets assassinated. So,
David, I spent a huge amount of time. I spent time preparing for this podcast, looking at losing vice presidential candidates as well. Cause I think that's something we want to discuss.
Yes.
And I would be very surprised if you know this. I only know it because it's on my screen in front of me. Do you know who was the losing vice presidential candidate in 1880, therefore Chester Arthur's opponent? If they had vice presidential debates then,
yeah.
Who would have
been? Oh, geez.
You are good at this stuff, but this is really inside baseball.
No, it's not coming to me.
William H. English.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know who that is.
You don't need to be embarrassed. I mean, William Hayden English was a member of the House of Representatives from Indiana, from 1853 to 1861, and then he comes back and he's a vice presidential nominee in 1880, unsuccessfully.
Right. So you know, maybe that's our ignorance of that particular political era.
No. I read the whole list and the number of these people who I thought, you know, obviously the recent ones were all familiar. But I thought, wow, you know, losing as a vice presidential candidate is really seals your fate and you're on the road to being forgotten. I mean, the list is – I mean, some of them were prominent in their day. Some did go on to do other things. But the vast majority, I thought, never heard of him, never heard of him, never heard of him. Or vaguely familiar, you know. So, in fact, I did some statistical background here. And we talked about this off air, so you can feign. I'll present it to you as a question that you can answer. Guess how many losing vice presidential candidates there have been, and how many of them have gone on to become president?
Well, I would imagine that there would be something in the order of 50 or 60 losing vice presidential candidates if we're only talking major party people.
Yes, we are talking major party.
Okay. And I don't know how many of those ended up becoming president.
There were 58 if we go back to the first election. But if we go post say 1840, there are 45 losing candidates. One went on to become president. A guy, a little known guy named Franklin Roosevelt, who ran for president, was a vice presidential candidate in the 1920 election, running as the running mate for James Cox in 1920. But only one has gone on to become president. So of this long list, and several of them are quite distinguished. You know, you've got people like Earl Warren, Henry Cabot Lodge, you know, and so on. Bob Dole, but the vast majority are kind of fairly marginal political figures who are largely forgotten. So that's very interesting, because I think the opportunity that's presented to somebody to be a vice presidential candidate for at least for the past, say, 40 or 50 years is one you have to take as a politician. But if you're on the losing side, I think the history and the public are pretty unforgiving.
Well, when you say have to take, I'm not sure we know that. Because I would imagine there's lots of people who have been offered this job and said, no, I'm okay with not taking it. Pick somebody else.
Well, I
and
guess
we don't necessarily know about those.
Yeah, of course, of course. And maybe, and we'll get into this, I think the modern selection process really begins in 1976, after the Democrats have their problems with Tom Eagleton in 1972. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, and so really serious vetting of vice presidential candidates in the kind of modern sense begins, and perhaps we're getting ahead of ourselves here slightly, begins with 1976. And I doubt that people who are uninterested would subject themselves to the vetting. So in other words, I think it, once the vetting begins, and it's pretty rigorous now.
Or at least it should be.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. We'll probably talk about one or two cases where it wasn't. But I would imagine that most people who subject themselves to that are willing to accept the role if it's offered to them. Do you think that's a fair?
Yeah, I think. Let's talk about Eagleton, because I think that's really an important sort of turning point.
Sorry, I've jumbled things up. Is there anything we need to say about the prehistory?
We can come back to that, because I think we're going to need to pick our sort of best and worst picks later on, because I think that will sort of bring out some of the interesting ones. Because I think, you know, in terms of the process, I think the 72 race with McGovern is sort of an interesting one. Do you want to tell the story about what happened with McGovern trying to find somebody to run with him?
Sure, I can start, and you can fill in the details if you like. Yes. So in 1972, George McGovern, and of course this is the election characterized by the Watergate break-in. In 1972, George McGovern was the Democratic nominee running against the incumbent Richard Nixon. Nixon would win in a landslide in 1972. He'd win 49 states. Only my native Massachusetts would vote for McGovern. When Watergate unfolded over the subsequent years, my mother had a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts," which was common in that state then. But the Democratic Party was in disarray. We talked about 1968 last week. As a result of the 1968 election, it had moved to the left. McGovern was seen as a kind of, well, he was portrayed, presented by Nixon, certainly, and the Republicans as a kind of extreme left-wing candidate. It's the kind of electoral move that Republicans have been using ever since against all Democrats. And in fact, Donald Trump's attempting to do it right now with Joe Biden. And McGovern initially selected in the summer of 1972. He selected Tom Eagleton, Thomas Eagleton was a senator from Missouri, to be his running mate.
And this was after, I think, he had already offered the job to a whole bunch of people who said thanks, but no thanks. Cause I think they saw where the likely outcome of the election.
Yes, that's right. That's an important point. And if they hadn't done the kind of math I just did of looking at only one successful, only one person has ever kind of revived their career after being an unsuccessful vice presidential candidate, these were savvy politicians and they were aware of it. So, yeah, they'd gone down a list of people who had passed on it. That's important. And McGovern selected Tom Eagleton, who was a pretty distinguished senator. He was, you know, he was absolutely fine. But unfortunately, he had a history of depression and treatment for depression, which included electroshock therapy. And this did not come out. There wasn't sort of the same vetting that had been done that has been done subsequently, and Eagleton was the nominee for 19 days in the summer of 1972. After the convention, he was announced at the convention. And Eagleton had had a conversation with his wife, and they decided not to divulge this information to the McGovern campaign. Eventually, the press got a hold of it. The press pulled at the thread, and reports started to come out about Eagleton's treatment for depression, particularly the electroshock treatment, and that was the kind of, if you will, the sensationalist aspect of this. McGovern initially backed Eagleton. He said he was behind him 1,000%. But then McGovern began to consult with doctors, and this is amazing, including Eagleton's doctors, the doctors who treated Eagleton, who said that a recurrence of his depression was possible and might endanger the country if Eagleton became president. Anyway, after 19 days, so nearly 3 weeks, Eagleton was replaced, withdrew from the ticket at McGovern's urging, and he was replaced by Sergeant Shriver. And they went on to lose that election in a landslide. Now, I think you rightly point out that a number of people passed on the opportunity to run with McGovern. The Democrats were in trouble in 1972 anyway. I'm not sure that Eagleton is – well, in fact, I'm pretty certain Eagleton isn't the one who cost them that election. But the
– Yeah, I think that the Nixon campaign meddling with things from the very beginning was part of the problem. Yeah.
Yes, but it fed a narrative of Democrats in disarray, which is a favorite kind of favorite trope of the media to this very day, and to some extent its modern iteration, well, probably begins in 68, but 68 followed by 72 makes the Democrats look like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. You're right, Nixon's dirty tricks didn't help either, but the Eagleton fiasco, if you will, contributes to the creation of this kind of more modern vetting system. After 1972, the Democrats and the Republicans do a much better job of vetting vice presidential candidates, to the extent now that it's become a really, really quite rigorous and extensive process. One, it should be said, and we'll undoubtedly get to this, that John McCain disregarded in 2008 when he selected Sarah Palin, and undoubtedly we might talk about how that played out. But so the modern system of vetting candidates, vetting running mates, really starts in the aftermath of 1972. Is there anything to add to that, David?
Well, I think you've pretty much covered it, right? I think that does sort of change the process in pretty important ways. That there's, because a number of people have sort of disqualified themselves after they've gone through vetting. The candidate looks at it and says, "Well, I don't want to be hamstrung by this nominee who are my running mate that has some baggage that they don't like." In thinking about the history of selecting a vice presidential candidate, both in the sort of 19th century model and the 20th century model, which selections do you think were the best selections, and which ones were the worst selections? Let's go with the best selections first. Who did a good job picking a running mate?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess. Because what are the considerations? You want I think some things that the press interprets as being important are not that important. So, for example, I don't think it's that important that I don't think geography is as important. And we'll spend a lot of time talking about that. Sorry, we as a culture will spend a lot of time talking about geography once Biden's pick is announced, because the discussion will be about whether she helps Biden or not. And I think too much attention is given to that. But on the other hand, what you really want is somebody you can work with and somebody you can work productively with. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I think Al Gore was quite a successful nominee, because he and Bill Clinton seemed to enjoy a decent working relationship, at least at the beginning. After the Clinton scandals unfolded, that was less so. I think Joe Biden enjoyed a very productive relationship with Barack Obama. I think, one can argue Joe Biden was a very successful vice president. Richard Nixon, surprisingly, was quite a successful vice president, I think, for Dwight Eisenhower. And they didn't know each other very well.
That one I think you can read a variety of different ways. Because Eisenhower in 1960 was asked, like, what did Nixon do as your vice president? And he said, well, I don't remember anything. I'm sure he did something. Get back to me in a week. But
but I mean, you know, Eisenhower had a lot of health problems.
To be sure.
During his presidency. Yeah, I think we tend, you know, it's very difficult to kind of look at Nixon apart from, you know, everything that came later, especially his presidency. But, you know, I think Nixon's earlier career is very interesting, is what I would say. Oh, look, I'm not here defending or, you know, promoting Nixon, but
as a pick,
I think, you know, I think Walter Mondale and Jimmy Carter were pretty good. George H.W. Bush was Iran-Contra's a big problem. Yeah. what do you think?
Well, I think the best pick would be Lyndon Johnson in 1960. In as much as, you know, thinking about the sort of tropes that we have in the later half of the 20th century about, you know, how you arrange a ticket, one of the things you want is sort of, or at least one of the traditional tropes is you want sort of a geographic diversity. And so you've got Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Johnson from Texas, and they come from very different parts of the party, and they come from different kinds of levels of experience. You know, and Johnson probably helped in thinking about a pick that may have helped a candidate win the race. You know, Lyndon Johnson does that.
Yeah, but Texas was solidly Democratic at that point.
To be sure, but, you know, Kennedy's a Catholic and he had those, you know, he had various, there were reasons why having, you know, and given that was one of the closest elections in American history.
But yeah, fair enough.
You know, if they lose one state, then things would have turned out differently. So I think that's one where that having that balance matters. Your mentioning of Al Gore, I think, is interesting because in some ways that was a selection that ran contrary to the conventional wisdom.
That's right. They leaned in. You got two people who were exactly alike.
Like, right. You know, so you've got one from Tennessee. Granted, he grew up in D.C., but, you know, one from Tennessee, one from Arkansas. Both Southern Democrats, both considered sort of from the moderate wing of the party, or sort of the, you know, almost conservative wing of the party, depending on how you want to frame these things. You know, so they're sort of a 2-for-1 deal of getting sort of a replica. You know, in some ways it depends on, you know, this idea of balance has always been an important sort of issue for who do you pick and how does it shore up your base of support within the party. You know, so thinking about, you know, you mentioned Eisenhower selecting Nixon, and it's clear they didn't always get along. At one point, I think Eisenhower actually tried to get rid of Nixon when he ran for re-election. You know, is that Eisenhower was not a career politician. Nixon was. Nixon had established his sort of bona fides as part of the House Un-American Activities Committee. You know, and gave that sort of wing of the party support for Eisenhower. And obviously Eisenhower was older and Nixon, even though
Nixon
we never
was
think
young.
Of Nixon was very young. We never think of Nixon being young, but Nixon was a young guy.
No, he was a young rising star of the Republican Party in 1952. I mean, I can't think of, you know, he had that sort of can't think of a contemporary, you know, but yeah, he was a young star.
In, you know, thinking also about balance, looking at, you mentioned George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, he's in some ways was a good balance for Reagan. They're from different parts of the party. One was a sort of an established party insider. One was a, something of a party outsider. And so that
he also had loads of national security experience and international experience, which Reagan didn't.
Right. And so, you know, thinking about how that balance works is, I think, it's often been. You know, and thinking about the debacle that led to Sarah Palin, right? You know, why did McCain pick her? I think it may have largely been trying to balance that ticket with McCain being a, you know, older white guy with a much younger white woman. So I don't know. Obviously, that didn't work out so well for either of them. Who do you think some of the worst picks have been?
Well, you just mentioned the one that immediately comes to mind, which is Sarah Palin. I mean, in terms of unpreparedness for the job. We'll never know because, of course, they weren't elected. But she seems, at least based on the evidence that came to light, we didn't necessarily have it at the time, seems to have been manifestly unprepared to be either vice president or president. And she proved to be an electoral liability. It's funny because if you remember that campaign, the Obama people were worried initially when she was nominated. The initial buzz for Sarah Palin was quite positive in the first few days. And she did quite well, you know, with her speech, you know, her nomination speech and so on. And there was a great deal of concern that she might be a game changer. The wheels came off once she started giving interviews, particularly that infamous interview to Katie Couric, where Katie Couric asked her what newspapers she read.
All of them.
Yes, all of them. and then with, of course, the financial crash in October of 2008, the seriousness, the implications of having Palin as potential president, you know, the gravity of that became apparent, mm-hmm. especially given McCain's age. Now, McCain, if he were running today, I mean, McCain was only, I say, in his late 60s at that point, by comparison with our current crop of candidates.
Biden's 77, so yeah.
That would make him young. But you know, the combination of McCain's age and concerns about his health and Palin's apparent unpreparedness for the job and lack of interest and ability and so on, I think that was a pretty catastrophic pick. And McCain picked her in part out of desperation because, you know, I think their internal polling was showing that things were not looking good for that campaign and he was rolling the dice. And that's one reason why she wasn't properly vetted, because I think they just thought, well, what do we have to lose? And I think that was a mistake. You'd have to say Nixon's selection of Spiro Agnew was probably not a very good pick because, again, it gets lost in all the Watergate stuff. But Spiro Agnew was a pretty disastrous vice president, and incredibly 19th century levels of corruption.
Yeah, so he clearly wasn't vetted before Nixon picked him.
No, that's right. In fact, he should be paired with Eagleton in that sense.
Well, but on, you know, because all the stuff is as in Maryland. But on the other hand, you know, Nixon, I think at one point said, and it may be apocryphal, you know, that no assassin in his right mind would kill me now.
Right.
You know, that, you know, part of the role of the vice president is to act as the attack dog to say the things the president can't say. And to that extent, Spiro Agnew sort of did that. You know, he could go after the Democrats in a way that made Nixon look presidential. You know, in the same way that Dick Cheney would do that under George W. Bush. My worst pick is Andrew Johnson.
Well, of course, yes.
you know, which is another one of these cases where this is when Lincoln's running for re-election. In 1864, they decide to establish this sort of new quasi-party, the Union Party, to try to signal their intention for reunification after the end of the Civil War, which, of course, at that point is still going on. And they select Andrew Johnson to be Lincoln's running mate. They ditch Hanville Hamlin, who Lincoln barely saw anyway. And, you know, he was picked for symbolic reasons as the one Southern Democratic senator not to leave with the Confederacy, you know, and I think as a symbolic gesture, sure, that's a great idea, but as a symbolic gesture that ends up becoming president, yeah, the disaster of Andrew Johnson we've talked about in the past.
Yeah, although the one thing I'd say, David, is that I guess in thinking about the question, I was thinking more in electoral terms rather than
sure
how they conducted themselves as vice president or president. So
that is the trick. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because Agnew and Johnson are both in the, wow, they were terrible picks because we know what happened.
Yeah. But although, you know, in both cases, they ended up, their candidate ended up winning. So it didn't hurt them sufficiently to matter.
That's right. You could argue that Andrew Johnson was actually a good pick, and you know, in the sense of, you know, it was during wartime. It was an attempt to forge a sort of unity coalition, if you will, in a unity government, and to signal that. It just turns out that he was a terrible, terrible choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, not necessarily electorally, though.
So, I mean, one of the things about the picking, the, you know, we can debate about how important picking a vice president is. I mean, one of the things that the selection of your running mate does, at least in the modern context, is this is one of the places where the candidate has to demonstrate their judgment.
That's right.
You know, and it does show people what kind of judgment that person has. You know, so thinking about McCain picking Sarah Palin, I think one of the things that that selection did, once especially she started to give these interviews, was people said, well, maybe McCain's judgment isn't as robust as we thought, isn't as considered as we thought it would be. Yeah, so how important then, I guess, you know, our discussion seems to suggest it mostly doesn't matter. Do you think it matters in this election?
Now, this is where I think there's a danger of recency bias, because I think it does matter this time, in part because of the age of the candidates, and particularly Biden's age. And I think whether he's admitting it or not, Biden, in selecting his vice presidential candidate, if Biden is elected, if he's not elected, this won't matter. But if he is elected, he's identifying the presumptive nominee for 2024 and the future direction of the party. Or there'll be a major fight within the party because that person is not going to be, she is not going to take the party in that direction. But either way, this is a turning point both for, again, assuming Biden's successful, it's a turning point both for that individual and for the direction of the, possibly for the direction of the country. So I think the stakes might be higher than usual because of that. And I also think that because Biden has committed to picking a woman, and that woman will be the third woman major party vice presidential candidate after Sarah Palin and Geraldine Ferraro in 1984. I think that, and you know, it's significant in that way, particularly if, as seems likely, he chooses a non-white woman. You know, I think this is, you know, and it's given this particular moment, all that's going on, not just the pandemic, but the Black Lives Matter movement and the kind of new civil rights movement that's ongoing, I think it's particularly freighted with significance. Now, again, this might all be recency bias. You know, we always think the moment we're living in is the most important one, but it seems to me more important than usual. I'm not sure it will make an electoral difference in the sense that she will give Biden or a particular state or not. I'm not sure that matters, unless he picks one of the candidates who's been mentioned from Georgia, like Stacey Abrams, because Georgia might be in play. So maybe that will make a difference. But you know, the other candidates that have been spoken of, and I don't want to list them all. You know, if it were Elizabeth Warren, well, if Biden doesn't win Massachusetts, he's not winning. Kamala Harris is from California. Tammy Duckworth is from Illinois. These are states that are kind of Democratic strongholds anyway. So I don't think it will make much electoral difference. One thing I turn that back on you. Do you think it matters? And then I have a follow-up question with regard to Trump that I'd like to put to you.
Well, I think nobody votes for vice president.
Yeah.
Right? So people vote for who's at the top of the ticket. And especially given how polarized the electorate is right now, given how far apart the two people at the top of the ticket are, you know, there's not that many people who are toss-ups and where that vice presidential pick may factor into it. I think your point about Georgia is a good one. I think there might be a handful of states, maybe just Georgia, where that kind of selection process might make a difference. You know, it's interesting thinking about the toss-up states in recent elections that, for the most part, people haven't selected running mates from those toss-up states, trying to sort of win that constituency. You know, no one has picked a running mate from Florida recently.
Or Ohio, yes.
Or, you know, and people have picked running mates from Wyoming. You know, so or Delaware, you know, which are not places that are usually contested or have that many votes to win.
Yeah, anyway. Although Hillary's selection of Tim Kaine is interesting because although Virginia now looks reliably blue, it wasn't reliably blue for very long.
Yeah, that's right. And so
to a certain extent that, you know, and again, Hillary was a woman who came up in national politics, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago when Virginia would have been a toss up or purple at best. And so there's echoes of that with Tim Kaine, but I agree with you. In general, they haven't picked – most candidates have not picked running mates from toss-up states. Well, Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan, of course, from Wisconsin.
That's true.
But yeah, I agree with your point.
Yeah. But I think you're right. This one, there's going to be more scrutiny of whoever the person is, in large part because of Biden's age. There's also I've heard some scuttlebutt, and obviously this is the kind of scuttlebutt one gets before a convention. There's always a slight chance that Trump ends up ditching Pence as vice president.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about.
So our great minds think alike.
Yes,
okay.
As do thorough mediocrity.
Exactly.
If, you know, Trump is almost, he and McCain hated each other, but there's a feeling about this election a little bit like 2008 where, you know, Trump might as well try something radical in the way McCain did, because why not? What the hell does he have to lose? And that is, to a certain extent, Trump's nature. And so one of the scenarios that I've heard, and this might have been the one you were going for, is he drops Pence, who doesn't bring him anything now, because Pence is, you know, again, if Trump doesn't win Indiana, he's lost the election. So, you know, Pence is from Indiana. Pence is supposed to give him evangelical Christians. Trump's already got at least evangelical Christians who describe themselves as conservative. He's not going to lose them if he dumps Pence. So it's hard to see what Pence is bringing to the table for Trump, that he throws him over for Nikki Haley.
And blames him for the pandemic.
Right.
Because he put Pence in charge of the pandemic, and so that means you can. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm giving up trying to predict what Trump's going to do. But, you know, he would be in keeping with a fairly long line of presidents who have ditched vice presidents they didn't like for whatever reason, for political expediency or what have you. FDR had three different vice presidents, you know, and that seems to have actually been a moderately common phenomenon. Given the nature of the conventions this year and how all those things are going to work, and the Republican conventions now behind closed doors without any reporters watching, which is going to be weird.
As we discussed last week, these are pretty much PR exercises right now. So denying access to the press seems an interesting move.
Well, but now the convention is just about the nomination process, and I guess he doesn't want to have rogue electors putting somebody else's name in nomination and people having that be on television. So I think Trump's going to have his own sort of media events elsewhere. But I could very much see the sort of possibility of that. You know, the one name of vice presidents whose name hasn't come up on our discussion yet, and who's one of the weirder vice presidents in American history, is John C. Calhoun, who was vice president for two different people.
That's right.
Because he was John Quincy Adams' vice president, and then they didn't get along. And then he becomes Andrew Jackson's vice president, and they didn't get along. And so he was a vice president who undermined both the presidents he worked with. If worked with is the right term for what Calhoun was doing. And I think I could see a situation in which Pence gets thrown under the bus.
So,
because Trump has a history, obviously, throughout his first 3.5 years of ditching people he one point said were great, and then decides they're not great and blames them for things, and then their persona non grata.
What do you think of Nikki Haley?
As a replacement.
If you're advising Trump, if he makes this move, is Nikki Haley the right choice? Because that's the name one keeps seeing.
If she would say yes to an offer like that, that would be an interesting pairing, especially if. As predicted, Biden picks a woman of color as his running mate. Then you have two women of color running against each other for the vice presidency in the debates, which I guess is the optic that Trump would be looking for there.
each of whom would be the presumptive nominee of their party 4 years hence, too.
Yes, presumably.
Although Haley, I think, is in an interesting situation because she has hewed very close to Trump even after leaving the administration. So she was the UN ambassador. She was very loyal and very outspoken in her loyalty and has been at a number of moments, including over the removal of statues more recently, which to my mind seems to be her signaling that she might be interested in this. On the other hand, Nikki Haley is not a stupid woman and she's young. And so, it would seem to me that her best bet would be playing a long game rather than being a losing running mate for Donald Trump. And as I've said, we've seen the history of what happens to losing running mates. One in 58 have gone on to become president. The odds are not very good that she'd be better off positioning herself to vie with the likes of Mitt Romney to battle for the future of the Republican Party after a Trump defeat. It seems to me she'd be better off playing that long game, not least because she's considerably younger than Mitt Romney.
Yes.
If I were advising Donald Trump, I'd say yes, that's a good move. If I were advising Nikki Haley, I would say don't touch her with a barge pole. You don't want to be associated with this.
Yeah.
But she hasn't distanced herself from Trump.
No. Well, weird things could happen. He could pick Kanye West as his running mate.
He could pick Ivanka.
Oh Jesus Christ! Don't make me think that. Okay. Right. Before we move on to last wraps, I just want to mention what I think is one of the greatest vice presidential candidates ever, and that is James Stockdale. Do you remember Stockdale?
I do. He ran with Ross Perot, right?
Perot in 1992.
So give us James Stockdale.
Well, so Stockdale was, so for those people who don't remember, Perot in 1992, you've got a three-way race for president. You've got the sitting president, George Herbert Walker Bush. You've got the Democratic challenger, Bill Clinton. And you've got this third-party candidate, Ross Perot, who was a Texas billionaire. And he selects as his running mate James Stockdale, so Perot is not a politician. He selects as his running mate somebody who's also not a politician. Stockdale was a Navy admiral. He had worked on behalf of POWs for many, many years. He was a really sort of admirable figure in all kinds of ways. But someone who was a complete political neophyte, who was working with a complete political neophyte, and they get invited to the debates, and then the vice presidential debate, and I think there may have only been one vice presidential debate that year. That's before the debate thing went sort of haywire. He starts off by saying, "Who am I? Why am I here?" As if, and I think rhetorically he was trying to introduce himself to the nation, but the way it sort of came across was like this old guy had sort of wandered into the debate stage and didn't know where he was or who he was. And so it's a sort of a sad thing that this military hero, the one thing he's remembered for now, unfortunately, is for his performance at the vice presidential debate in 1992. But we get some weird picks, people trying to figure out who to run with.
Well, and you do. And going back to that era again, I think we should look at, or at least pay passing mention, the great moment in vice presidential debate.
Oh, yes,
at least recently, is Lloyd Benson, who ran with former senator from Texas, who ran with Mike Dukakis. And Dukakis, who was from Massachusetts, was trying to recapture that little of that that Kennedy Johnson magic, I think,
sure.
with the Boston to Austin axis and all that kind of stuff. So he selects Lloyd Benson, who's a longstanding senator, pretty nondescript, if, truth be told. But Benson debated Dan Quayle, famously, in 1988, and Dan Quayle invoked Kennedy, and that's when Benson famously said, "I knew John Kennedy. John Kennedy was a friend of mine. You're no John Kennedy, or Jack Kennedy, as he put it." And that's a very famous moment. It's long remembered. In fact, there's been a recent investigation of that, or sort of research on that, showing that Benson had that line queued up. He was ready to go. Basically saying that Dan Quayle was a callow and unprepared candidate, which was true. But of course, Bush and Quayle won in 1988.
Yes.
So it kind of goes to our larger thesis that this pick It always seems important when it happens in August of the election year. It's not really, it's probably not as significant as we think, unless it is for unforeseen reasons, if that person should become president and either perform very well or very poorly subsequently.
To be sure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we will see who Biden picks probably next week, it sounds like, although they keep moving around the date of when they're going to announce this thing.
Yeah.
Right. What is your last drop, Frank?
I want to endorse an article that appeared in the New York Times 2 days ago on August 3rd by Christine Hauser called The Masked Slackers of 1918. You can find it. It's a very interesting article. And what Hauser did, what Christine Hauser's done in that article is investigated the debate over wearing masks in public during the 1918 and 1919 in particular, during the great flu epidemic or pandemic of that period. And what's very interesting there is the degree to which many of the same arguments we're hearing today, especially in the United States, from people resisting wearing masks, saying they're unhealthy, they don't help you, they actually make you sicker, some people invoking their rights, et cetera, et cetera. There are clear resonances with today in this, and there were similar debates then as there are now. Most people wore masks, but not everybody. She focused in particular on San Francisco, and there's an incident there where a health inspector confronts a guy who's prominently a protester not wearing a mask outside a bank. When the health inspector confronts this guy, the guy coming out of the bank hits the health inspector with a bag of silver dollars. The health inspector ends up taking out his gun and he wounds the guy who won't wear a mask.
This does sound like stuff right out of the news, because you hear about these kinds of things going on right now. So
exactly. Anyway, it's a very interesting article. It's a very enlightening article, and so that's my last drop. I recommend that to you. Still available on the Times website, so it's from a couple days ago. But the Mask Slackers of 1918 by Christine Hauser. What about
you? You should bring back that terminology, mask slackers.
Yes, I think that's good, isn't it?
It's good.
What's your last drop, David?
We've been staying home this summer, just like pretty much everybody else is, and so our vacation's been off the table, at least for the summer and probably for the foreseeable future. And so what my family and I have been doing for the past week or so is we've been going on virtual vacations via a video game, called GeoGuessr, which is an online game in which they plop you – there's sort of couple of different versions of it, but they basically plop you down on a random spot in the globe using Google Maps, and then you have to figure out where you are.
Oh, interesting.
And your score is based on how close you are within to the actual location. So you'll be we've been a variety of places. We've been in Romania, we've been in Brazil, we've been in rural parts of Canada, and they plop you down. You sort of have to sort of deduce from, context clues exactly where you are. And sometimes we've been able to get within 5 yards of where the original spot was, and sometimes we've been hundreds of miles away.
Have you been any place you've actually been?
Yes. There was one time where they plopped us in North Dakota, and we said, "Oh, okay, we know where that is." there's a couple different, when you go, it's on a website, it's free. They have a couple different games. So the main game is where they plop you down on a place, and it's usually some place rural, and you have to sort of drive around to find out where you are. And we once spent 2 hours trying to figure out what part of New Zealand we were in, because it was sort of in the middle of nowhere. But eventually we found it, and that was good. But they also have another game where they plop you down at a historical site, at a castle or at a thing. And you have to figure out where you are. And a couple of those I'd been to. So they plopped us down at Mount Rushmore, and we're all like, oh, okay, this is easy. We know where this one is. We're considering these virtual vacations. So,
Excellent. Good.
We do it from the comfort of our couch.
Excellent.
As of one should all things. All right. Till next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.